Hello, everyone, and welcome to E2R's first e-learning of the spring 2018. We have a great topic for you today. It is common employment law misconceptions, and we're going to go through some scenarios with you and then outline some really good stuff that's in some recent cases. It's going to highlight those misconceptions for all of us, but as normal, before we get started here, there are a few reminders. Ordinarily, if there are questions, we ask that you put them in the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen. Please feel free to do that as well today, but unfortunately, given the length and breadth of this presentation today, we will not be able to get to them during the presentation, but we'll be sure to follow up with any of our clients who have questions, and we'll set up calls through our client care team. In case you missed any of the past webinars, you can find the recordings over on e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentations can be found in your member portals. If you don't know how to access your member portals, again, please reach out to our client care team. They'll be happy to provide you with the appropriate direction. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind all of you that the information contained within our webinars is an overview only, and if not intended to be an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. As always, please contact us with your specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic, and we will set a call up with an advisor. For those that are looking forward to next e-learning, it's going to be April 26th, so mark that date in your calendar. You will get an email invite in due course. Now, without further ado, I pass it over to Alexandra, who's going to begin our wonderful presentation today.
Okay, so in terms of the agenda and what we'll be chatting about, we'll start with some misconceptions with respect to hiring, probationary employees, overtime, vacation, resignation, termination, and then we'll have a nice conclusion. So the first one is with respect to hiring. So this is our hypothetical. Stuart, the new candidate for the finance position, will not consent to a pre-employment criminal and credit background check that we normally perform on candidates. He says it's an invasion of his privacy. He is right. We are not allowed to do these types of background checks anyways, so we might as well just give him the job. True or false? Okay, this is false. Criminal and credit background checks on candidates are permitted, especially when they relate to the position in question. However, tread carefully with background credit checks. Some jurisdictions require clear, explicit consent. So credit checks are only really appropriate to use if you're hiring somebody that is kind of working with money or has an opportunity to commit theft or fraud. Otherwise, it's not really applicable and you shouldn't really even be considering a credit check. As a best practice, ensure that offers of employment are conditional upon the employer receiving the background check. And ideally, these checks should be completed before a candidate starts working. However, that's not always doable. Sometimes you need somebody to start sooner rather than later. So in those instances, the language in the offer of employment has to say or should say that the offer is conditional upon those checks being satisfactory. Note that the Police Records Check Reform Act in Ontario may have an impact on when you receive the police record check from a prospective employee. Some other considerations are that even if a request for a criminal record check is permitted, once an employer is in receipt of the results, you have to consider the applicable human rights legislation to determine if it's permissible to refuse to hire that person or terminate the employment of an existing employee. So, for example, in Ontario, a person can't be discriminated against in employment because of a record of offenses. So employment decisions cannot be based on whether a person has been convicted and pardoned for an offense under federal law, as such as the Criminal Code, or convicted under a provincial law, such as the Highway Traffic Act. Employers must look at the person's record of offenses and consider whether the offense has a real impact on the person's ability to do the job and if there's risk associated with them doing it. So examples might be if you're hiring a bus driver and they have serious and repeated driving convictions, that would be relevant. Or if you're hiring a daycare worker who works alone with children and they've been convicted of child abuse in a daycare setting, that would be relevant. Also, with respect to criminal background checks, obviously it's ideal if it's performed prior to the employee commencing employment, but if the need arises to conduct the check after, it may be permissible in Ontario in some circumstances. I'm going to go over a case that demonstrates this. So in this Ontario Court of Appeal decision, the issue was a client of the employer imposed a requirement that anyone working on its project provide a criminal record check. So all the existing employees, they didn't have any language in their contracts that said that they were going to perform this check. This arose later. As a result, the employer instructed all employees and contractors to consent to a criminal record check and provide the results. This one employee refused to consent, and as a result, her employment was terminated. The employee argued that her employment was terminated in bad faith by requiring a criminal background check that was not required or contemplated by her employment agreement. The court rejected this argument as the employer had communicated to all employees why they needed the check, i.e. the client had imposed the requirement, and the employer had notified all employees that if they refused to consent, it would result in termination of employment. So if you ever need to conduct a record check and it hasn't been addressed in the employee's offer of employment, contact us. We can advise you with respect to the liability and draft a communication to employees explaining why the check is required.
Second statement on hiring an economist conception. Lindsay was so great in the interview that I hired her on the spot, and she's going to start on Monday following Easter weekend. I did forget to tell her about the fact that we never pay more than minimum employment standards upon termination, but that's fine. I'll give her an employment agreement for her to sign when she comes in on her first day. Now, is this going to be fine or is this not going to be fine? As many of you know, it's not going to be fine. It's false. We need to always be mindful that oral statements made in the interview process or part of the recruitment process may be characterized as offers of employment that are capable of being accepted orally by the candidate. Also, a failure to advise the candidate of the fundamental terms of the job before they begin working for you will preclude an employer from imposing upon those conditions after the employee starts without providing additional or what we call fresh consideration in exchange for those terms. So we need to be clear during the interview process that an offer will be made in writing and that no formal offer of employment should be considered to have been made until the written offer is provided to the candidate. So again, if we're orally making an offer, we need to make it very clear that this is going to be followed by a written contract that they need to sign. And as you see in that last point, in all caps, we want to make sure that that contract is signed prior to employment. A recent case that kind of goes through this issue. So we have, as the facts, there was an employee was offered a job on a phone call on a Friday night. I guess they were in a rush to get the person on board. On that call, the parties agreed to a start date, the job title, and the person's starting salary. Obviously, on Monday, that employee quit his old job and reported for work for his first day. He worked all day Monday and was given a written contract on that day. So on his first day, he took it home and he signed it and returned it the following day. As recommended, the contract did include a 3-month probationary period clause, which said that he could be let go without any notice or pay in lieu of notice. The employee was subsequently dismissed during that 3-month probationary period. However, he decided to sue his employer for wrongful dismissal. The court found in favor of the employee and highlighted that the employee never received valid consideration when presented the written offer of employment. So the court took the position that the oral contract was in fact the contract that had the valid consideration, and the written terms that went along with it following the start date, so the probationary period, I'm sure a termination clause, non-solicitation, all the rest of it, wasn't valid or enforceable because the employee was not getting anything additional of value. And in that case, even though the employee worked for less than 3 months, they awarded the employee 17 weeks of notice. And there are cases that have even gone above that amount of notice for probationary period employees that were terminated without a valid probationary period clause. So we want to make sure, again, that we're presenting a written offer before the person starts, and that all oral discussions are very clear that this is not an offer of employment until you sign off on the written terms.
Okay, next statement. So Stacy has been with the company for 1 month. She just told me over lunch that she has a history of depression and that she's been feeling a little down. She signed an employment agreement with an enforceable termination provision prior to her first day of work. I better remember to make a note in my calendar to let her go before the end of her probationary period, while the company can still let her go for any reason and not owe her anything. True or false? False. This is a common misconception. I had a chat with somebody yesterday about this. So under employment standards legislation, there's no obligation to provide notice as long as there is an enforceable termination provision more than employment standards if they're terminated in that first 3 months. However, you can't terminate an employee without notice if there's any kind of human rights or any, or if it seemed to be a reprisal underneath the occupational health and safety legislation. So essentially, if an employee discloses they have a disability or requests an accommodation for a disability or family status, there could be significant human rights exposure even if you terminate them after month one.
So we're going to talk about overtime. Our clients, one of our clients' top 10 favorite subjects to go through. And so we're going to talk about, obviously, no one ever wants to work overtime in my business. We have to do an inventory every quarter, and I can never get enough employees to work overtime to ensure the inventory process is completed. However, this year, to avoid any issues, I'm going to make overtime mandatory so we won't run into staffing issues. Now, is that legally allowed or not? Well, the answer is no, except in Manitoba, but. So Manitoba is the only province which specifically requires overtime to be voluntary or by agreement. However, most provinces do have limits on the amount of daily or weekly hours that an employee can work. So essentially, we've listed all of the rules here below. You can review them at your leisure as it relates to your workplace. But in essence, the issue is you can permit someone or can require them to work overtime except for the province of Manitoba and within those hours of work thresholds. Now, be mindful of a couple things, one of which would be this ever-expanding area of family status. If an employee says, I can't work overtime because I have childcare obligations, well, we're probably going to need to explore whether or not you have a duty to accommodate that individual and allow them not to work the mandatory overtime. But just be aware that this is one area where we do have some flexibility or some additional power as an employer, as long as we stay within these excess hour limits.
Okay, next statement. China is a great employee. However, she keeps working overtime, even though the overtime has not been authorized by her supervisor. We are going to refuse to pay her overtime because the hours were not authorized. Employers can refuse to pay overtime, true or false? I also had a conversation with this yesterday. This is false. If an employee actually performs the work and works overtime, an employer cannot take the position that the overtime was not authorized and therefore can refuse to pay overtime. It doesn't matter if there's language in the employment agreement saying that overtime has to be authorized. It doesn't matter if you have a policy saying that overtime has to be authorized. You still have to pay it. You can discourage employees from working overtime without authorization. If you have a policy or if it's in the agreement, you can discipline them for failing to follow the policy or the direction, but you still have to pay the overtime.
Vacation. So Erin has used up all of her vacation entitlements for this year. She wants to borrow some paid vacation time from next year in advance. This is okay because if she's terminated before she earns that time through our accrual-based vacation system, we will just get her to pay it back by deducting the money from her final pay. Are we permitted to make a deduction from Erin's final pay for overused vacation? The answer is no. Typically, deductions from wages such as these are generally not acceptable for overused vacation. In very specific circumstances, legislation does permit an employer to make deductions from wages with an employee's written authorization. The rules do vary according to the jurisdiction. So if there is a question about making a deduction, whether that's by way of authorization or otherwise, we're going to want to have a quick discussion as it relates to whether the law permits this. And like Alexandra, I did have a call on this last week with regards to some broken company property, and the employer wanted to make a deduction. They had an authorization, but unfortunately in that jurisdiction, since multiple employees had access to that property, even with a written authorization, a deduction wasn't permitted. So it's going to depend upon the jurisdiction. With vacation specifically, in most jurisdictions, if you have an authorization signed, you can make that deduction, but always double check with us and we'll even help you draft the appropriate paperwork for that.
Okay. Leora is a key employee of ours. However, she is so busy at work that she never takes her 2 weeks of vacation every year. Our vacation policy is clear. It's a use it or lose it policy. Therefore, she is no longer entitled to take the vacation time that she did not use in the previous calendar year. True or false? False. Employers must ensure that employees take the minimum vacation time required as per the applicable provincial employment standards, or make such alternative arrangements as permitted under the legislation. Minimum vacation entitlements cannot be taken away from employees. However, employees in most provinces, with a few exceptions, which I'll outline, who are provided with vacation entitlements in excess, like over and above what the employment standards provide, may lose that extra vacation if it's subject to a use it or lose it policy. And there's a few exceptions. In British Columbia, Manitoba, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut, an employer cannot implement a use it or lose it on the greater benefit. The employee has to be paid what the greater benefit stipulates and be given the appropriate time off. And for federally regulated employees, Newfoundland and Saskatchewan, you have a use it or lose it policy on the greater benefit, but you can't use it or lose it with respect to the vacation pay.
Let's talk about resignations. This also came up last week in an issue I was dealing with a client. So great, Christy has been a disruptive employee since the day she started, and she just stormed out of my office as she shouted, "I quit. I'm never coming back to this awful, awful job again. And so I'm so glad that we are rid of her." Unfortunately, one day later, she called and said she wants to come back, and I said, "No way, sorry, you resigned." Now, did she in fact resign from her position by virtue of the words and actions that she exhibited? The answer is likely no. The law of resignation requires clear and unequivocal actions or statements demonstrating an intention to voluntarily leave. Typically, the employee is expected following the resignation to actually do something that it's consistent with the verbal resignation. For example, if they collect their personal effects, they return company property unprompted, they ask for a reference letter perhaps. Heat of the moment resignations do not typically meet this test. So if we want to make sure that an employee is actually resigned, we want to ask them to take their time and confirm the resignation to the company in writing. So someone's words and maybe even leaving the workplace is typically not enough. Now, we're going to explore a recent case that highlights some of the other aspects that might be taken into account by a court. So, we had an employee who worked as a law clerk, not here, but somewhere else, with 27 years of service, and she was responsible for coordinating the work at other law clerks at her office. Now, the employer met with her and informed her that another law clerk who was returning from mat leave would be responsible for the coordinating duties going forward. The employee left work early that day, and the following day, the employee attended the office and removed her personal belongings and returned her security pass. The employee contacted the employer 5 days after the return of the security pass and asked to return to work. So she had a change of heart. The employer did not allow the employee to return to work and took the position that she had resigned. The employee retained legal counsel and brought an action for wrongful dismissal. So obviously the court wanted to look to see whether there was actions and conduct that amounted to an unequivocal resignation in the context of all the circumstances. So we're not just looking at simply the words and the actions, but we also want to look at the underlying facts of the matter and this particular employee, like all things. So the court noted that the employee had 27 years of service, and that the employer did not make any inquiries when she did drop off her items. Also, the employee did not provide the employer with any written notice of resignation, and at no time even verbally stated that she resigned, even though her actions suggested that she may have been doing so. And the court found in that case that the employee did not resign and that she was entitled to damages for wrongful dismissal. What's not on that slide is that the court also found that the employer was happy to have her go and looked at this as an opportunity to get rid of her. And so when the facts are present where it looks as though the employer is in a better position that the person has left, they are going to dig a bit deeper to make sure that the resignation is clear and unequivocal.
Okay. Next hypothetical. Michelle is an excellent employee with over 7 years of service, has an excellent performance review record throughout all her years of service. Clients and coworkers alike love her, and she has received full performance-related bonuses in all her years of service. A judge will never let us get away with terminating her. True or false? False. All employees, even the best performers, can be terminated at any time for any reason or no reason, provided that the proper amount of notice of termination is given to the employee and provided there are no human rights violations. So basically, if I don't like an employee because we got into a fight over The Bachelor or I don't like the color of their shirt, I can terminate them without notice as long as I pay them out their entitlements, and that's fine. The use of the term wrongful dismissal in employment law can be confusing because it can lead to the misconception that good employees cannot be terminated, which is obviously simply untrue. The termination of a good employee on a without cause basis simply requires, like I said before, that you provide working notice of termination or pay in lieu of that notice or severance pay, if applicable, to the departing employee. So the minimum notice or pay in lieu notice requirements are found in the relevant employment standards legislation, and additional notice may be owed under the common law if the employee isn't on a good contract with an enforceable termination provision, or if you operate in Quebec under the civil code. Please note that under the federal and Quebec minimum employment standards legislation, employees can dispute their termination if the dismissal is unjust federally and not for just and sufficient cause after 2 years in Quebec. Also, in Nova Scotia, after an employee has 10 years of service, you can't terminate an employee without just cause. So those are the exceptions to the general rule.
Let's talk about some common exceptions related to termination. And so I heard that Alex is an incredibly lazy employee. He's even fallen asleep on the job on occasion. His work is sloppy, his clients are always complaining about his abrupt manner, and the company is terminating him. And given his poor performance, he is not going to be provided with any notice and is not entitled to any notice. Now, is that going to be true or false? As many of you know, we've talked about all these types of scenarios. I hope Alex doesn't lose his job. But if he does, it's not going to be cause in this case, because our courts have said time and time again that terminations for cause are the capital punishment of Canadian employment law and are therefore reserved for specific instances where there has been irreparable damage caused by the employee to the continued relationship. Now, the word cause is a very specific legal definition and cannot be interchanged with the word reason. Obviously, you likely will have a reason to terminate Joe, Sally, Smith, or John, but you may not meet the test for cause at law. And so when we are going to be terminating someone for cause, we need to make sure that our progressive disciplinary processes are in place and are followed. So we're going to need to have likely numerous warnings increasing in their severity as it relates to specific conduct in order to establish just cause. Now, we still might have a very good reason to terminate someone, but to disentitle an employee from any pay in lieu of notice, we're going to need to have that file really thick, except for obviously those kind of real serious matters like workplace violence, for example, or serious theft, fraud, embezzlement. Those very serious matters, we might not have to have a thick file, but otherwise we're going to want to have a file. And there is obviously a heavy onus, like a heavy file on an employee. We do need to kind of meet that. So if an employer claims that an employee is just incompetent, it's likely not going to be enough for just cause dismissal, as I've said to numerous clients over and over again. As it relates to performance-based cause, it almost needs to be to a point where the person is doing their job bad on purpose, or there's no other reasonable explanation as to why they're doing their job poorly. So we've got to make sure that we have that standard. And also, lastly, just always keep in mind that when we are terminating someone for cause or attempting to do so, we need to take a contextual approach, meaning we need to look at all of their factors. So a short service person is going to have less leeway as it comes to incidents as someone who's been with us for a longer period of time. Also, were there any mitigating factors related to the performance issues? Are they not getting along with their supervisor on a real and sustained basis? Is there an underlying kind of bullying situation? Or looking back to last month's e-learning, is there perhaps a mental illness that we need to look into as to why someone's performance has significantly dipped in recent months versus their long tenure? And lastly, although not noted on the slide here, I do want to emphasize that when we are terminating someone for cause based upon an incident, we do have to conduct an investigation into that incident and give the person a chance to explain their misconduct. Our courts have said, especially recently, that even if there is some conduct that is just cause, we need to meet the procedural fairness element of just cause, and therefore they should be given a chance to explain their misconduct. You don't have to buy it, but they do need to be given a chance to explain it and face the evidence, and then we feel more comfortable going forward with a just cause termination. A nice case here, Kurtz and CarQuest Canada Limited, 2015 Ontario case. There was an employee who was a director of ops with 5 years of service. The employee persistently failed to satisfy the employer's reasonable performance standards despite being provided repeated warnings and resources to assist him in meeting those standards. Leading up to the employee's eventual termination, the employee's performance was repeatedly assessed, in this case in June 2009 and April 2010, and he was notified that he was failing to meet the company's performance expectations. So later on in that year, in September, the employee was provided a final warning notifying him that there were items that required his immediate improvement and that a failure to respond to the warning by virtue of improved performance would result in his immediate termination for cause. Now, before we switch slides, just think about that fact scenario and what I said about I'm establishing just cause. And do you think we had just cause? Well, after the warning, they terminated him for cause, and the court found that in light of the nature of the performance deficiencies, which were in part linked to systemic issues, the employee had not been provided a sufficient amount of time to improve. And the court determined that the employee's performance deficiencies were not serious enough to support his termination for cause and awarded him 8 months reasonable notice. So as you can see, in this case, we had an employee that had 5 years of service. There were some other issues as it relates to why his performance may have not been up to snuff. And at the end of the day, if we're going to terminate someone for cause based upon performance, we do need to establish essentially that they're being bad on purpose. And so that's a high threshold to get to. And unfortunately for CarQuest Canada Limited, they did not get to that standard.
And one thing just about when you want to terminate somebody and there is ongoing performance reasons, because of this and because it's so hard to get to cause, often clients want to chat with us about performance improvement plans. And often if you don't actually anticipate that the employee is going to improve and you think they're a little bit of a lost cause, sometimes it's best just to action the termination on a without cause basis and save yourself a lot of time and effort. Just something I wanted to point out. Next statement. My cousin Megan, the criminal lawyer, tells me not to bother calling our employment lawyer when our family business terminates an employee. She remembers learning in law school that there is a simple formula for calculating common law notice, and it is equal to 1 month per year of service. True or false? False. Now, in this slide, we're chatting about common law reasonable notice. So obviously in this scenario, there was no contract with the termination provision limiting the employee to employment standards. So I know it's tempting to try to identify an easy way to calculate common law reasonable notice. Clients are often a little bit frustrated when we can't identify an exact formula or tell them exactly what their exposure is. But unfortunately, at common law, the only thing that's clear is that there's no hard and fast rules, and there's no limit upon the factors that can be considered. So good employees do not get more. Mediocre or bad employees do not get less. There's no such thing as near cause. Also, keep in mind that if you're terminating somebody for cause and it goes in front of a judge, that judge does not care what your reason for the termination was. They don't care if they were a crappy guy that was late on the job all the time, was falling asleep at his desk. They're only going to look at some of the following factors. So they're going to look at age, length of service, the availability of suitable employment, the character of employment, whether they were induced from their last job, things like that. Also keep in mind that courts tend to award disproportionately high common law reasonable notice awards to short service employees. And sometimes those notice periods can greatly exceed their tenure. And I'm going to look at some cases now that demonstrates that. So the first case is this 2014 Ontario Superior Court of decision. So the employee in this scenario was terminated from the position of data services engineer after 51 weeks of employment, so just shy of a year. He was 31. He held a mid to senior position. He made about $95,000 a year, and the employer offered him a package of 2 weeks at the time of termination. The employee sued for wrongful dismissal damages, claiming that he was entitled to common law reasonable notice. The court looked at the factors that we chatted about on the last slide. They considered his age, the less than 1 year of service, the availability of similar employment, and his mitigation efforts, and they awarded him a reasonable notice period of 4 months. So he had less than a year and got 4 months. So as you can see, not the 1 month per year service rule didn't apply in this scenario. Here's another case. So in this scenario, the plaintiff provided services to the employer as a contractor, and he invoiced his services to the bank on a monthly basis. After a two-year period, the parties were in a process of drafting a contract by which the plaintiff would switch from being a contractor to an employee. Before the plaintiff's employment contract was finalized, the bank's majority shareholder decided to discontinue the venture. So the plaintiff was advised orally by the bank that he was terminated, and he then brought an action for summary judgment seeking pay in lieu of notice. The court considered the plaintiff's age, he was 61, his length of service, 2 years, and his senior position in determining the appropriate reasonable notice period. The judge also commented that it didn't matter whether the plaintiff was an employee, that the plaintiff wasn't an employee at the beginning of the relationship. He held that even if the plaintiff was not an employee, he was a dependent contractor and therefore would be entitled to the same reasonable notice as an employee. The court determined that he was entitled to a notice period of 8 months, which came out to approximately $150,000. So 2 years, 8 months, $158,000, not insignificant.
And I guess what both these cases do really highlight is the importance, again, of having a clear termination provision, because it's not clear as to what your monetary exposure is going to be upon termination unless we have that valid contract in place that limits them to the minimum or some other agreed upon amount. I think it's going back to the earlier misconceptions. We want to make sure that we're doing everything possible to make sure that those contracts are enforceable in terms of them having being properly presented with the contract and oral offers and all the rest of it. So all this kind of blends into other things. And so we'll lead off with this last statement, I believe, where Leah has been paid everything that she was entitled to in accordance with her employment contract. I paid her what was set out in the employment agreement, and I got her to sign a release in a termination meeting. The company does not have to worry about her and her threats of bringing a claim against the company anymore. Now, is that statement, looking at all those factors, true or false? The answer is going to be false because on a number of different grounds, and I spoke to a client about this not too long ago as well. We need to make sure that we are providing some form of additional consideration in exchange for the release, unless the contract itself provides for an extra amount that is conditional upon a signed release. So I cannot provide someone with their minimum employment standards amount or their minimum contractual amount absent release language in the contract and ask them to sign a release and expect it to be enforceable because they are getting no more than what they are legally entitled to under minimum employment standards or a contract. And so we're going to want to always make sure that that is there, and we also want to make sure that our releases are drafted by a lawyer. There are often times when we pull a release off of some download website or on the net somewhere else, and we think it's sufficient and it doesn't reference the proper jurisdiction or the proper legislation or what have you, and that's going to be problematic if the release isn't drafted properly. We also want to make sure that the employee has been provided sufficient time to review the release and the termination letter with the offer, and we want to make sure that we never, ever permit an employee to sign a release in the termination meeting. There are going to be legal arguments to set aside a release that's signed during a termination meeting, so we always want to make sure that we are indicating to the person to review the letter at home, seek whatever advice they want to seek, and return the release signed to us at a later date, typically providing them with at least 5 to 7 days to return that release. And so lastly, courts will carefully scrutinize the circumstances surrounding the signing of a release when a claim is brought, so it must be signed voluntarily or will not be upheld. So one of the arguments when they sign it on the spot is that it wasn't voluntary, it was under duress. And the other argument about not providing extra consideration is that it's not a valid contract at the end of the day. And so we're going to go through a case that's going to talk about similar issues here. It is the Salakin and Alpine Aerotech Limited Partnership case from BC 2016. The employee was terminated in this case for cause due to his inappropriate behavior in the presence of a safety auditor. Never a good thing. When the employee was terminated, he read the documents provided and signed the release in favor of the company on the spot. As we discussed, a big no-no. Despite having signed the release, the employee sued for wrongful dismissal, probably because they talked to their uncle who was a lawyer or a lawyer at some point or his aunt or whatever, and she said he should sue. The release won't be enforceable, and he claimed he was entitled to 6 months' pay in lieu of notice. The court found that the release was, in fact, as we've alluded to, unenforceable because he was not given sufficient time to review the documents, and there was intimidation and pressure used during the termination meeting. And I would argue that even absent a finding of intimidation and pressure, there's going to be a good chance that a court's going to set aside a release that was signed on the spot. And so we were more efficient than we thought, so we've reached our conclusion early, so you can go and actually enjoy your lunch now. But let's conclude things quickly. As you can see, we've highlighted only a few of the common misconceptions, and these misconceptions can lead to costly consequences. As Alexandra and I have pointed out today, these topics come up very, very frequently. And even though we've talked about these topics today, and you may believe you have the answer to certain things, We always urge you, before you tackle any employment-related issue, to reach out and talk with us. We are here to address everything, and as we have harped time and time again, each situation is going to be different than the next. And so that relates to using the same documents over and over again for things, or treating Joe the same as Sally, because that's how it worked out last time. Each situation is going to have unique circumstances that may impact the legal advice, approach, and strategy. So don't ever hesitate to reach out to us. There's no issue too small. So with that, I want to thank Alexandra for her hard work and her great presentation today, and look forward to speaking with you all again soon. And we will be back in April with a new topic, and we hope that you all join us then. Thank you very much. Bye.